So welcome, everybody, to the Chronic Liver Disease Foundation GAP PBC podcast series. I'm joined here today with Dr. Sonal Kumar. She is an assistant professor at Cornell and also the director of clinical hepatology at that institution and an expert in PBC. So it's great to talk to you. I'm Kimberly Brown, and I'm a professor of medicine at Henry Ford Hospital, and I'm a professor of medicine at Wayne State University as well as Michigan State University. So welcome, Sonal. Good to see
you.
So the topic tonight, again, PBC, and one of the things that I wanted to talk a little bit about, which we, you know, we kind of gloss over, is how do you manage patients, you know, with first-line therapy, ursodiol? What kind of doses do you, you know, shoot for your patients? And most importantly, how do you think, you know, how do you think that patients tolerate it?
Yeah, so, you know, ursodiol has been such a huge component or a huge part of our management of patients with PBC. And I start people right away as soon as they're diagnosed. And I use weight-based dosing, the 13 to 15 milligrams per kilogram per day. In the past, I used to divide it up QID or TID. But now usually I do BID dosing for most of my patients, which seems to be well-tolerated and less missed dosing. Overall, people tolerate it fairly well, I think. You know, you will see some side effects. Sometimes I'll have, especially on initiation of therapy, I can see patients who have some abdominal discomfort, some GI side effects, but that usually goes away with time. Or sometimes I'll just slowly escalate the dose if that happens. One of the side effects that I do see, I wouldn't say commonly, but not uncommonly, is hair loss. And that's something that especially women will mention to me once they start the medication if they notice that. Those are probably the biggest ones. Maybe a little bit of weight gain every now and then. But overall, a pretty well-tolerated medication.
One of the things that I'm not sure I see it as much more recently, but that certain generics, certain doses, you know, because like you can get it in 250 or 500, 300, that sometimes I would find that my patients who didn't tolerate it, you know, GI side effects or whatever, or fatigue, that they would tolerate a different formulation. Did you ever see that?
Yes, that's actually a good point. I've had patients who have come to me and said, I like this. You know, their insurance made them change their formulation or whatever the reason or the dosing changed. And they said that I have many more side effects from one over the other. But it's not one, you know, one formulation over the other. It varies from person to person. I completely agree. Yeah, completely agree.
Yeah, it's interesting. I could never sort out like, oh, well, you'll tolerate this one because it was the next person didn't tolerate that, but would tolerate the opposite one. It's
completely
weird,
agree. I definitely see that.
So, these second line therapies, now that we have, you know, several available to us, obviously the clinical trials were done as an add-on, right? Second line therapy, but also were used in patients who were, quote, intolerant to URSO. Do you have much experience with using these second line therapies in patients who really didn't tolerate URSO, and obviously when they started medication were not on URSO?
Very little experience. I think, I found that the majority of patients can tolerate URSO. Mm-hmm. I think I have one patient that is on second line therapy who was completely intolerant of URSO and is actually doing well on second line therapy.
Yes, true.
But for the most part, it's, you know, a very small percentage of my population. I don't know. Do you see it much?
I don't. I think I probably have one patient that I, you know, can think of that with an alternate, you know, generic or whatever, couldn't really tolerate Urso. And what do you think about the utility of Urso for pruritus?
I haven't found that it makes much of an effect in PBC. You know, I don't think patients have who have pruritus have responded or had any impact, either better or worse, in on pruritus when they're taking Urso, at least not in my practice that I can think of.
Yeah. So one of the things that we were talking about on a different podcast is sort of how long you wait until you say, well, you know, time to change, right? What kind of, what targets are you looking at, and how long do you think it is on average, you know, before you're like considering second line therapy?
Yeah, I mean, I used to wait the entire year to assess patients for second-line therapy in sort of in accordance with the ASLD guidelines. But I think, you know, we as providers are shifting away from waiting the entire year as more and more data comes out. And, you know, we have an idea by 3 or 6 months that whether or not patients are going to respond or need second-line therapy. And so I've really shifted to, at the very least, have the discussion at 6 months, and potentially even start patients on second line therapy sooner than the 1 year mark.
Yeah, I think that's what all of us are doing now. I know the guidelines haven't quite caught up yet, but I think everybody who treats a lot of the disease are really kind of moving to that earlier time point. I think in large part, don't you think, because we recognize that after 6 months, I mean, I don't think I've ever had a patient truly come into the normal range between 6 months and 12 months, unless they really weren't compliant, right?
Yeah. Unless compliance was an issue. Absolutely. Completely agree. I think by 6 months, you know, this is an estimate, but like 90% of the response happened there, you know, during the first 6 months, and then very minimal if you... happens after that.
And then, you know, when you are thinking about adding a second line therapy, obviously there's, you know, insurance issues with, you know, what medication will be covered by insurance. But, you know, insurance issues aside, how are you talking to your patients? Are you talking to them about potential side effects? How are you preparing them? What are you telling them in terms of this is how I'm going to measure whether, you know, you're responding to this medication? What kinds of things do you talk to your patients about preparing them for second line?
So, you know, I like our patients to be as informed as possible. I think, you know, the more they know about the medication they're about to start, the more likely they are to continue it, to be compliant, to contact you if there are any issues, et cetera. I like to have it be a team decision. So I always talk to them about potential side effects and the efficacy, you know, about what percentage of patients respond, what can we expect to see? You know, I don't tell them that their alkaline phosphatase is going to normalize in 2 weeks. You know, I want to set the expectation, you know, to be realistic. And so I, you know, try to lay it all out during the when we're discussing second line therapy. And then when starting any of the new medications, I usually bring the patient back at 4 weeks, either to see me or one of the APPs in our clinic, so that we can address any concerns, make sure they're still taking the medication, talk about side effects, you know, whatever it may be. And I found that works out really nicely, because anytime a patient is starting a new medication, there can be some anxiety or hesitancy or uncertainty from the patient perspective. So if you bring them back to talk to them, and really, I like to do it in person, or, you know, not just a phone call, if we have the bandwidth or if the patient is able to, so that we can really sit down and talk to the patient about how they're doing.
Yeah. What, you know, I'd be interested to know, like, you know, it's hard to talk to a patient about a medication that's not maybe going to make them feel better, you know, and that's really all they have to, you know, as feedback, right? How do I feel? Oftentimes, you know, in liver disease, we're treating patients to extend their life. We know we're going to slow their disease. How does that translate? Sometimes it's hard for patients. Do you use like FibroScan, for example, or some kind of hard measurement to, you know, to give patients feedback? Yeah, your alkaline phosphatase is normal. I know you don't feel different, but, you know, here's another endpoint. I mean, what kind of endpoints do you use to try to encourage your patients to stay on therapy and keep going?
Yeah, I mean, we check FibroScan in patients. We do the FibroScan and we go over the results. I think the FibroScan is hard to use as an endpoint early on because it's not going to change that dramatically right after you start therapy. So, you know, at the 4 week, 3 month, whatever it may be the same. And it, so patients have to understand that, you know, not the expectation that we would see a dramatic improvement in your FibroScan score. And I think that's where lab parameters, alkaline phosphatase, bilirubin really come into play. And I try to explain to patients what, you know, alkphos is a marker of, why we're following it, what's the data behind it, how we know that, you know, the higher your alkaline phosphatase is, the, you know, the more damage that is being done to the liver, and that translates to clinical outcomes down the road. And, you know, we want to try and get it within the normal range as soon as possible and keep it in the normal range. So I really try to get patients to understand what that means, because that's, I think, true. Labs are probably the best, you know, the fastest endpoint we have to show them that a medication may be working.
Yeah, I agree. I think in the short run, I use labs, you know, because patients like to see those things, right? They like to track it and see that it's normal, and then to understand, like you pointed out, what normal means and how that impacts their health. But then I do FibroScan once a year, and yep. My goal there is actually to show them stability, not so much that they're, you know, their KPA's gone down, but more to just say, look, you're stable, right? You've got good liver function, and it looks like, you know, the medication's working because we don't have a lot of progression. So I don't know.
Think that's a good point. You know, lack of progression is also important.
Yeah, right. All right. Well, I just want to, you know, thanks so much for joining me. It's great to see you. And thanks to everybody who listened to the podcast series. There'll be more to come. So hopefully you can enjoy the additional podcast series that we have on PBC. So good to see you. Thanks.
Thank you.